and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
Hello, everyone. I'm Bob Main, and you're listening to the Handgun World Show. Why do I carry a gun? Because I can't carry a cop. Thanks for tuning in. This is episode number 71. It's called Brains and Bullets. And you'll understand as you listen to this show why I called it Brains and Bullets. I think in order to properly defend yourself, there are two things that you need if you're going to carry a gun. Number one, you need brains. You have to train your mind. Your mind is the ultimate weapon. So I'm going to talk about training your mind. I've got a good audio clip for you to listen to about training your mind. And, of course, you have to have the bullets. Now, bullets, gun, kind of goes together. And that's your weapon. That's your secondary weapon. Your mind is your primary weapon. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. I've also got some listener feedback, and I'm going to set the stage with four key points I think you need to have to maintain safety for you and your family. So let's start with some listener comments. You know, I always love getting feedback, positive or negative. I don't care. Some of you have actually sent me some negative feedback, which I'm going to address, and a couple of positive feedback emails here that I want to talk to you about. And again, I'm an open-minded guy, so any way I can make this show better is great. This is your show, not mine. I'm just the Yankee behind a microphone. Anyway, as I make my way through traffic here, I'm in my car, again, taking advantage of some windshield time. Let me share, first of all, an excellent email from Jerome from California. Now, Jerome from California is part of the Gun Rights Radio Network. And I'm going to go ahead and put a link to everything that he does, and I'm going to put a link to an excellent podcast that he did a while back on the Makarov. But he was making a comment about my military surplus guns podcast. Seems like that was a popular podcast. That's just something that I just kind of got a whim to record that, and as you know, I started off on military surplus guns. But here's what Jerome says. He says, Bob, I thoroughly enjoyed your surplus gun episode. I own a commercial Makarov and a Yugoslavian 5966 SKS rifle myself. You were spot on with the correction you made about the Finnish Mosin Nagant being very accurate. Some Mosin Nagants were actually American-made by Remington and Westinghouse. You know, that I didn't know. Thanks for sharing that, Jerome. I didn't know that. Only a few made it to Russia because of the communist uprising there and the Bolshevik Revolution. A lot of the rifles remained in the U.S., and Remington and Westinghouse had to be bailed out by the U.S. government. The use-marked Mosins are probably the most sought after by serious collectors. Another fascinating fact is that the Mosin Nagant remains in service today. I didn't know that either. Albeit a highly modified version of the Finnish 7.62 sniper rifle. But, of course, those are being sold as surplus rifles yet. And, by the way, Jerome from California did an excellent job reviewing the Makarov on the Gun Rights Radio Network Gun Review Podcast. I'll link to that. You need to go back and listen to that. He did one of the best reviews I've ever heard on the Makarov. So, Jerome, thanks for that info. Thanks for adding to it. And he complimented me on my show. Thank you very much. And go to the Gun Rights Radio Network link that I post in the show notes and listen to his review of the Makarov. Thanks, Jerome. Another listener put a comment on the website at handgunworld.com. And he made a comment about the surplus rifle episode that I did, or surplus gun episode. And he said, I listened to this podcast today and I thoroughly enjoyed it. The only thing I might have added would be a discussion of Curios and Relics FFL. For $30 for 3 years, it's one of the best deals going. It's in most states. You can have rifles, shotguns, and pistols that come under the CNR rules, CNR being Curios and Relics rules, shipped directly to you. And Brownells and Midway give you a dealer discount. So, yeah, I forgot about that. And, sir, you know who you are. Thanks for sending me that comment. I might want to get myself a CNR license. That's something to think about. Listen, in fact, reading this comment's kind of got me thinking about going that route. So two excellent comments. Thank you. I'm going to address a couple of pieces of criticism that I got, but I'm going to do that in segment number three. So the first thing I want to talk about here in segment one, to set the stage for the rest of this show, Brains and Bullets, I want to talk about four key points to maintain safety for you and your family. The first key point that I want to make is you've got to be properly trained. And I believe that a properly trained armed civilian is more in control of a violent encounter that may happen to him or her than someone that has not received any training. And I'm going to talk a lot about civilian defense because, as you know, I'm not a gunsmith or ex-law enforcement or ex-military. I'm not a combat trainer. I'm not a CCW instructor or anything like that. I'm just a private citizen. So I study things that private citizens need to know, and that's kind of what I talk to you about. And it's better to be trained. It's better to have your mind trained and your gun skills trained for a violent encounter. Okay, the worst thing that can happen is a chaplain showing up at your home to explain your death to your family. I know that might sound kind of harsh, but the reason we carry guns, folks, is to stay alive. Now, I know that there are some people that carry that are irresponsible and untrained. And sometimes, if they don't know what they're doing, they could escalate that bad situation because they're carrying a gun. So you need to train your mind as to when to shoot, how to shoot, and then, of course, have the skills to be able to place the bullets where they need to go to stop your aggressor. Unfortunately, a lot of people just don't simply get that training. So let's move on to the second topic that I want to talk about. If you're not ready to use your handgun to defend your family, then you might as well just leave it at home or don't even buy it in the first place. If you're going to carry it and you're going to train with it, be ready to use it. Now, I am not advocating going out and shooting people for no reason. Please don't accuse me of promoting any violence on this show. If you've been listening to me long enough, you know that I'm not that kind of person. That's not what I promote. Those of us who carry guns, we do it because we want to stay alive. That's what it's all about. But if you seriously think about this, what good is it to get a handgun and train with it and then leave it at home? Carry it. It's simply amazing how many people get a concealed carry license and then don't carry a gun. It's shocking. And I think in a future podcast, I'm going to try to look up some statistics on that if I can. How many people have a CCW license but don't carry their gun? I'm not quite sure if anybody out there has been tracking that kind of stuff or really has any accurate information. But if they do, I will put it up on this show and I'll talk about it. The third point to maintain safety for you and your family that I want to discuss is to remember something about the police. The police are here to protect the masses. And, you know, I open every show by saying the reason I can't carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. You know, I joke around with that a little bit, but I'm halfway serious. And I'm not picking on cops. I had somebody email me when I first started doing the show saying that I was picking on cops. Let me go on record one more time saying that I'm not picking on cops. I just know something, that they can't be there all the time. They can't be around 24/7. And by nature of the way violence occurs against people, usually police show up after the fact. All right, there are rare exceptions. I mean, there are some occasions where the cop and the officer is there at the scene when something is happening or gets there very quickly to be able to stop it, but that's rare. Officers are generally in a reactive mode rather than a proactive mode. Typically, they're showing up after the fact and they're reacting. Your survival and your safety is up to you, plain and simple. There's just simply not enough police officers out there. And folks, with the way things are going today, I really just don't think that we just realistically cannot depend on the police to be there 24/7 to protect us. So consider that. And the fourth point that I want to talk about is laws. I know we have laws, and we have a set of laws and a set of punishment for criminals. That doesn't stop them. Every day, violent acts are committed against civilian citizens, whether we have laws or not. It doesn't matter whether there's laws out there. Criminals just don't obey them. I mean, come on. This is just simple common sense. And yeah, there's a lot of bad guys that are caught and punished after the fact. But I have a question to ask you. Should your family's safety be an afterthought? All right? You know, a lot of people wait until something happens to them to go out and get a concealed carry license. You know, it's very similar to my regular profession. My regular profession is in the security alarm industry. We do other things too. Our company is very diverse. We manufacture a lot of products, but one of the major products that we make are security alarms. We're a manufacturer. We're not an installer. But I run into all kinds of situations where people will install a security system in their home after they've been broken into. I've always scratched my head. What's up with that? People never seem to act beforehand to prevent the burglary. You know, same thing with your family's safety, to prevent yourself against violent acts. Get your CCW license now. Get your handgun now. While you can, exercise that right and start carrying it. Don't let your family's safety be an afterthought. Don't wait till something happens tragically and that chaplain does show up at your door to spread the bad news. Get it now. And use your Second Amendment rights to carry your handgun. All right, so those four key points I want you to think about. Make sure you're properly trained. Make sure you're ready to use your handgun. Remember, the cops are just there to protect the masses, and laws don't mean anything to criminals. Now, I want to cover a couple of announcements just real quickly, and then I'll move into segment number two. I got some good information from Gabe Suarez to share with you in segment two. But as for the announcements, I'm going to keep this relatively short. I don't like to get real commercial. As you know, I've got a freedom raffle going on. I'm trying to raise some money for some real good causes. The Gun Rights Radio Network. So far, the NRA is in the lead. You guys need to get on the Gun Rights Radio Network forum, and you need to vote and tell me where you want a large portion of the money to go to. It's your decision. Majority wins. But the Freedom Raffle, folks, if you haven't heard about it already, I'm giving away a Ruger LCP. Engraved. Very nicely done. There's going to be four winners. One of them is going to win a gun. Two people get to win a $100 holster from CompTac, $100 gift certificate. I'm giving away two of those for anything that CompTac makes. And fourth, a $100 gift certificate to knivesandgear.com. A friend of mine has a website, Knives and Gear, and he's donated $100. You can get on there and you can buy yourself a pretty nice knife for $100, folks. So get on there and get a raffle ticket. They're only $10. Now, let me say something about buying raffle tickets. PayPal has decided that they don't want to have anything to do with guns. Now, I've heard this many times, and I've never really experienced a problem with them until now. PayPal called me last week and said they were no longer going to process payments for my raffle because it had to do with guns. And when I asked the lady, why are you doing this? She goes, well, it's just our policy, sir, that we don't pay for anything that has to do with firearms. So I'm boycotting PayPal. I've kicked them to the curb. I've had enough of them. If they're not going to support our Second Amendment rights, I certainly am not going to support them. And I would suggest that you don't either. I'm going to go ahead and ask you right now, don't use PayPal whenever you possibly can. Use an alternative. As for my raffle, I have a GunPal account on handgunworld.com. By the way, somebody asked me if they have to have a GunPal account to pay. No. You can use any major credit card or debit card. You don't have to set up an account with GunPal to pay. You can go ahead and plunk your credit card number in there as well. If you go to handgunworld.com, you'll see a big donate button with a G in front of it. That's the GunPal system. They're very gun-friendly, and they have decided that it's not a problem processing payments for gun-related items. So use that. Go to handgunworld.com, and just go ahead and send me $10 per ticket, and I will mail the tickets out. I just mailed some out this Monday to those of you who bought tickets last week. It's going real well, and next Monday I'll be mailing out the rest of the tickets for the people who buy them this week. So use that donate button. It works. All major credit cards are accepted. Also, don't forget handgunworld.com and my YouTube channel and also my Facebook page, Handgun World Show. By the way, the raffle's going to end September 1st. I'll do the drawing on September 2nd. I'll be videotaping the drawing so you can see what happens. All right, that's it for the announcements. I want to keep that short and sweet, but let's give the gun rights folks our support. If you want to know more details about the Freedom Raffle, I won't take up any more time. Go to the website. You'll be able to see it. So that ends segment number one. Let's take a 30-second break. I'm at the stop that I have to make, so I'm actually going to take a longer break than 30 seconds. But you'll hear segment number two. When I get out of my appointment, I'll dictate segment number two. So you'll hear that here in about 30 seconds. So here's some music, and I'll be back on shortly. Thank you.
The forums are a great place to interact with the podcasters and other listeners to your favorite podcast. Visit GunRightsRadio.com and click on the forums button at the top of the page and sign up for your free membership. GunRightsRadio.com.
Okay, folks, before actually concluding this segment, I just realized that there is an audio soundbite that I want you to listen to. It's called The Bulletproof Mind, and it's kind of playing into the theme of this show, Brains and Bullets. Listen to Dave Grossman on The Bulletproof Mind, and I'll be back on with some comments. Here you go.
Most law enforcement officers wear soft body armor to protect themselves physically on duty. But physical protection is only part of what it takes to face a violent adversary and win. Hello, I'm Chuck Remsburg, co-founder of Caliber Press and co-producer of the Street Survival Seminar. Today it's my pleasure to introduce one of America's most provocative and popular law enforcement trainers, Dave Grossman, who shares important insights into the mental component of officer survival. Dave is author of the Pulitzer Prize-nominated book called On Killing, son of a career law enforcer, former Army Ranger, and a specialist in helping officers develop mental body armor, what he calls the bulletproof mind. Your understanding and training in the physical tactics of survival, of course, are crucial when your life is on the line. That's nothing new. But trainers and officers alike too often give too little attention to the fact that in a gunfight, your brain is your most important weapon. And in this program, it is your brain that Dave Grossman trains to win. Over the next 2 hours, he prepares you mentally and emotionally for the challenge of defending your life. First, he discusses the predator mindset versus yours, what your adversary brings to the confrontation that you may not be expecting. Next, he explores the dynamics of combat, how the extreme stress of a life-threatening encounter affects your mind, and what you can do to best control your response. Then he looks at the realities of taking a life, what it feels like to use deadly force, and how surprises can sabotage your survival if you are not prepared mentally. And finally, he examines what you may face after the smoke clears, including different threats you may confront after your career ends. There was a time in this country when you could go 20 years without ever drawing your sidearm. That time has passed. Today, the violent world you work in makes new demands on your mental and physical skills, regardless of how long you've been on the job. Dave Grossman begins the sharpening of your bulletproof mind with a glimpse into the world you enter every time you put on your uniform and gun belt. It's a world you need to better understand, to go home safely at the end of every shift. Now, here's Dave Grossman.
We're living in the most violent times in peacetime human history. The murder rate in America since 1957 has approximately doubled. Took a nice little notch down in recent years, but the bottom line is we're still at about double the per capita murder rate of what we had in 57. If you're looking at the problem across any period of time, you have to ignore the murder rate. Murder rate completely misrepresents the problem. Why? Because medical technology saves ever more lives all the time. A wound that 9 out of 10 times would have killed you in World War II, in Vietnam, you would have survived that same wound 9 out of 10 times. If we had 1930s level medical technology in America today, the murder rate would easily be 10 times what it is. So what you got to look at is not the murder rate, but the rate at which people are trying to kill one another off. The best measure across any period of time is the aggravated assault rate in America. And the assault rate has gone from around 60 per 100,000 in 1957 to over 440 per 100,000 by the middle of this decade. It is an explosion of violent crime that is absolutely unprecedented in peacetime human history. So step one, we understand the explosion of violent crime that's happening around the world. In Canada. Now, there's a great nation, right? Everything ought to be all hunky-dory in Canada. They've got all those great gun laws, right? And they've got this semi-paternalistic, socialistic government. And they've got limited racial problems. And they got the cold that drives all the riffraff off. Everything ought to be perfect up there. Well, in Canada, since 1964, the assault rate has gone up fivefold per capita. And attempted murder, a classification we do not have, has gone up sevenfold just since 1964. In Norway and Greece, the per capita serious assault rate went up fivefold. In Australia and New Zealand, it went up approximately fourfold. In Sweden, it tripled, and it approximately doubled in Belgium, Denmark, England, Wales, France, Hungary, Netherlands, and Scotland. Never have we seen such a dramatic increase in the willingness of members of a civilization in peacetime to kill off the fellow members of their own society. Imprisonment in America has gone from a little less than 100 per 100,000 in 1970 to over 440 per 100,000 by 1997. A 4.5-fold increase in that ratio of violent citizens that we are locking away. Now, there is no doubt in anybody's mind that if we let these people out, it'll be even worse yet. Every now and then, somebody will say something like, well, you know, Dodge City in 1875 had four times the per capita murder rate of New York City. Stop. Think. Just a minute. Number one, what was Dodge City full of? Young men coming off the trail drive, right? We had this skewed demographics in which it was primarily a concentration of individual in the prime crime years. Number two, if we had 1870s level medical technology in America today, the murder rate would easily be 20 times what it is. You know, after World War II, we had this big batch of kids, and they all hit their prime crime years in the 60s and the 70s. But since around 1980, we have been an aging society. The number of individuals in those prime crime years, that ratio of our population that are in their teens and their 20s, has actually been going down. And yet, in spite of the fact that we're an aging society, some of the most dramatic increases in violent crime happened in the late 80s and throughout the 90s. Actually, what's happened is we're kind of in the eye of the hurricane right now. Starting around maybe 2002 or thereabouts, the children of the baby boomers are all going to start hitting their prime crime years. Now, that'll start working against us. And in 97, we bought a 2% decrease in the assault rate. Now, that's a good thing. We're glad of it. We'll take anything we can get. But in the same year that we had that 2% decrease in the assault rate, we had a 21% increase in law enforcement fatalities. How can that be? How can violent crime go down 2% and law enforcement fatalities go up 21% in the same year? The major factor holding down violent crime in America is this. Ever more law enforcement officers, ever better trained, ever better equipped, are aggressively pursuing the criminal. They're taking back the night. They're taking back the streets. They are aggressively going out and doing their job. They're being held accountable for bringing down the crime rates, and that's what they're doing. But they're doing it at the price of their blood and their lives. Number two, the individuals that you face out there on the streets have a capacity for violence that transcends anything we've ever seen before. You are dealing with individuals who are incredibly well qualified and trained. You're not dealing with ragtag, odds and ends criminals out there. You're dealing with individuals who are motivated to kill in a way that we have never seen before.
As you know, statistically, the most violent segment of our society, the most threatening segment to you, has always been offenders who are young. And these days, they're getting younger. In Dave Grossman's view, there are powerful influences molding the minds of our youth in negative ways. And for those inclined to criminality, there are modern-day opportunities for skills training that make them far more dangerous, potentially, to you.
A child, up until they are 5, 6, sometimes even 7 years old, can't tell the difference between fantasy and reality. The part of the brain that kicks in that allows you to organize and discern where information came from does not kick in until you're 6 or 7 years old. And so what happens is, when a 2, 3, 4, 5-year-old sees somebody being shot, stabbed, raped, brutalized, degraded, murdered on TV, for them it's real. And they are traumatized and brutalized and convinced that the world is a dark, horrific, brutal, desperate place. And the only kind of people who function and survive in that world is what? Violent people, people who kill. And the average preschooler in America spends more time watching TV than any other single act other than sleeping. And that TV has a pervasive influence on them of incredible power, and the violence over the TV is tremendously effective. Anywhere in the world that television ever appears, with very few exceptions, 15 years later, the murder rate doubles. Every single time, what we see is an explosion of violence on the playground, and 15 years later, there's a doubling of the murder rate. Why does it take 15 years? That's how long it takes for them to grow up. That's how long it takes for you to reap what you have sown. We're traumatizing and brutalizing our children at a young age in a way that has not happened since the Mongols dealt with their children in that particularly brutal and horrific way. Think about the impact of this brutalization. The things that we learn in those young years cannot be unlearned. And they lie there latent, waiting for the proper circumstances for them to come out. Now, it doesn't happen to everybody, but a surprising, horrendous portion of the time it happens.
Okay, do you have a bulletproof mind? A couple of things that really stood out about that audio clip from Dave Grossman that really stood out in my mind was, first of all, when he said you can't look at the murder rate, you have to look at the aggravated assault rate, the number of people trying to kill each other. See, that's what you have to look at, and I 100% agree with them. I think that's what we have to focus on, is how many people are out there trying to do some harm to us. And if you remember some of the math that he talked about, the aggravated assault rate has multiplied by, I think, 8 times, from like 60 to 440. Almost 8 times since the 1950s, the aggravated assault rate. Provocative, huh? Maybe I ought to say the reason I carry a gun is because of the aggravated assault rate. Another point that I thought he made that was very profound is when he talked about the capacity of violence among people out there. And he talked about how the ability and the willingness of people to commit violence seems to be much far greater than it used to be. And that, I thought, was very, very profound as well. The fact that we're dealing with individuals that are motivated to kill more now than they ever have been. So, think about that. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. It's a rather old video, rather old audio clip, because he talked about figures from several years ago. But not much has changed, folks. And it's a fantastic series, even though that was pretty much geared towards law enforcement. Even those of us who are private citizens can gain a lot from that in making your mind a bulletproof mind. So, with that, that concludes segment number one. Let's take a 30-second break here, 30-second musical break, and then I'll be back on with segment number two and talk about some of Gabe Suarez's information about things that might get you killed if you train improperly. So, after the break, I'll be talking about some silly gun school things, as Gabe talks about it. Gun school things, in other words, what they teach you in gun schools that could get you killed. All right, talk to you in a bit.
The Brady Campaign is telling America that 85 people are killed with guns every day. What they are not saying is that nearly 60% of those deaths are suicides. Subtract those, justifiable self-defense shootings, and some very rare accidents, and the real number is 33 deaths each day. But the federal government tells us 80% of those deaths are gang violence. So the number the Brady should be talking about is 27 gang shootings a day, or less than 3 each for the 10 largest cities in the country. The Brady campaign needs to come clean, for once. Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
Okay, segment two. I want to talk about some training again. And I want to talk about some gunfighting training. As you know, I'm a big proponent of Suarez International and just about everything Gabe teaches. Gabe Suarez, I agree with and I think is just fantastic teaching. I happen to think he's one of the premier trainers out there. And he made an excellent, he wrote an excellent article called 10 Silly Gun School Things That Will Get You Killed. I'll say that again, 10 Silly Gun School Things that will get you killed. And when you listen to this, I think you're going to be rethinking maybe how you might be training right now, because you got to be careful where you go and who you take courses from. It is possible, as I've heard other people say, to train the wrong way. So this might upset a few people, but seems like the last couple of podcasts or so, I've been good at upsetting people. but it's Gabe's opinion, and fighting needs to be pretty simple. I've long subscribed to the theory that there's only one rule in a fight, and that is to win. And this article by Gabe Suarez seems to echo that you got to win. That's the rule right there. And it's kind of similar to martial arts. You know, my son takes martial arts. I've talked about that a couple of different times on this show, I'm pretty sure. One of the things that bothers me, I'll tell you something I don't like about some of his martial arts training. He takes mixed martial arts. I don't like the fact that there's so doggone many rules. And I know that they have these rules to keep the kids safe. I mean, the instructor's not going to grow his school, and he's not going to, you know, get a lot of parents wanting to bring their kids there if they're getting hurt all the time. So I understand that. Some of this is for safety. But I think they sometimes go a little overboard. I mean, let's face it. If you're going to take martial arts, be prepared to get hurt. Really. I mean, I don't understand why people will go to a martial arts class and then complain that they got hurt training. I'm scratching my head over that one. Anyway, I try to educate my son that the only rule in a fight is to win. Walk away alive. That's the only rule that you've really got. And so I'm trying to help him differentiate between what is practice and what is training and what is real fighting. Some of the things that they teach him to do in martial arts, he cannot do. That they teach him to do things if he's in a real fight, he cannot do them in the classroom when he's training with the other kids in that martial arts school. Now, for someone who's 12, sometimes it's a bit difficult for them to differentiate, because he's had a few instances lately where he's been in some conflicts with some kids, and just recently, my kid was hanging around another kid that he shouldn't have been around. And the other boy grabbed him and pulled his arms back behind his back and was trying to wrestle him to the ground. My son knew exactly what to do, and used some of his martial arts training to end that altercation pretty quick. Now, what he did is not allowable in his class, but I'm glad at that point he differentiated between class and real life. He realized, hey, man, this kid wants to drop me on the ground. I got to do something to get out of this. To me, that's a win. So let me get back to gunfighting. A win is not necessarily killing your aggressor. Some people get the wrong idea about those of us who carry guns. I'll speak for myself and probably a lot of you who are listening to this podcast. We're not a bunch of trained killers out there. Really bothers me when the gun media, the gun-hating media, likes to portray people going to rallies and going to gun rights events, and they like to portray us as a bunch of kooks and nuts and a bunch of fringe dwellers that are idiots. And I got to say, I'll agree with a lot of what Eric says on the Handgun Podcast from time to time, where he says, hey, you know, if you're going to demonstrate and you're going to demonstrate about gun rights, do it professionally. Because all you're doing is you're giving the enemies, the gun haters, ammo to use it against us. I 100% agree with that. And so let's not let the media paint this as a bunch of extremists. And I'm not talking about that right now. I'm not saying you should go out there killing people with your gun. If you are defending yourself, if you're defending your life, and you pull that trigger to stop your aggressor from doing his heinous act, if he dies and you were acting in self-defense, so be it. He shouldn't have been attacking you in the first place. If you can stop him and he doesn't die, stop shooting. Let me say that again. If you fire and your aggressor stops what he or she is doing to you and they don't die, stop shooting. I hear crazy stuff like, if I have to pull my gun, there's only going to be one side of the story and that's going to be mine. I'm sorry, I don't completely buy that. I'm not in 100% agreement with that. If you fired too many times, if you have gone overboard, if you fired when you shouldn't have fired, I think you're going to find yourself in a heap of trouble, whether it's your story and there's no nobody else's story or not. So be real careful. That's why any training that you can get that discusses when to use your firearm is incredibly vital if you're going to carry a gun. So I just want to make that very clear that I'm not advocating violence at all. So winning a fight sometimes is simply getting the chance to walk away. And that's why we carry guns, so that we have a better chance to walk away from a bad situation. And Gabe mentions that point in this article about the 10 silly gun things that could get you killed. Oftentimes people teach a lot of things that are wrong, and it's hard to convince gun owners that they sometimes do things wrong. That's hard. I'm kind of bullheaded like that, folks. Yeah, sometimes I don't want to admit that I'm doing something wrong. I try to keep an open mind as much as possible, but I'm going to throw my hand in the air and say, I struggle with that too. So here's one of the points that Gabe makes. He talks about selecting holsters and gear. And he says that sometimes people select holsters and gear that are really not suitable for fighting. They select holsters that are good for the range and good for gun games and stuff like that, but they don't select types of gear that's good for fighting. Now, let's get back to rule number one of a gunfight. I'll differ with Gabe on this article a little bit. He says the rule number one in a gunfight is to have a gun. No, rule number one of a gunfight is don't get in one. Avoid it. Get out. Go away. Don't be in a gunfight if you can help it. If you find yourself in a gunfight, then rule number two is to have a gun. That's absolute. I mean, you got to have a gun. If you're in a gunfight, you don't have a gun, folks, you're screwed. Okay, so having that gun, it's a real disservice to tell somebody that they have to carry a custom 1911 or something like that, and they got to go out and spend a whole ton of money on a gun, and they have to make sure that it has a good, cool-looking logo on it, and that it's got to be a certain color and all that in order for them to be defended. And some schools teach that. Some schools teach you have to have one specific type of gun. Some instructors are that way. I don't like instructors that pretty much only focus on one type of gun. Some people just can't carry that. Some people just can't carry a 40-ounce all-steel gun. I don't carry a 40-ounce all-steel gun. To some people, that's just not practical. For those of you who can do it and do it every day, more power to you. That's awesome. Not me. Every once in a while, my car PM9 gets the call. It's a gun. And it's a gun that can do a pretty fair amount of damage with someone that knows how to use it, and I practice a lot with it. And I've talked before about the mouse guns in 380. It's better than not having a gun at all. Okay? I don't buy the argument that you shouldn't step down in gun if your situation calls for it. I think if you have to step down in gun, and what I'm talking about is, you know, should you be carrying a full-size, mid-size, 45, 40, or 9mm, or, you know, should you step down and carry a pocket gun if that's what the situation calls for? If there's just absolutely no way you can put a larger gun inside your waistband or outside your waistband and go on with your activity, if the only thing you can do is slide a 380 in your back pocket or in your hip pocket, that's fine. It's not my primary method of carry. I'm not going to say that you're doing the absolute most you could do to be defended, but you never know. Maybe the situation is that's all you can get away with. A 380 with the right kind of ammo in the hands of a trained person is probably going to make your aggressor think twice and stop the attack. If you know what you're doing with it, you can place those 6 or 7 shots where they need to be. Your attacker is going to have a bad day. And there are some people that say that they teach realistic gunfighting and they forbid the use of a Glock or an XD or an M&P pistol in an inside-the-waistband holster. I've talked to people like that too. I've talked to people say, you should never put those striker-fired guns without a safety in a holster. They're too dangerous. Got to have a manual safety on that gun. Baloney. Keep your finger off the trigger, practice good gun handling techniques, and it doesn't matter whether it's a striker-fired gun without a safety or whether it's a hammer-fired gun with a safety. See, I don't buy that garbage either, and I've heard that. Everybody points to the fact, well, what about all those accidental discharges out there from people carrying guns inside their waist without safeties? Well, the accidental discharges is because the person's being a dope, right? They're being an idiot. They're not practicing good gun handling techniques, and that's why there's an accidental discharge. Now, that's not to say that striker-fired guns without a safety are less likely to be accidentally fired. There is something to be said about 1911s being safe guns because three things have to happen. You have to depress the thumb safety, you have to depress the grip safety, and you have to pull the trigger. And yes, when you're reholstering, the chances might be less with a 1911. It's not an issue, folks. I've reholstered my Glock many times, and I've even done practice out that's not in a match. I've done practice out on some farmland, and I've reholstered with the gun loaded, with the gun hot. And as long as you're paying attention to what you're doing and your finger is nowhere near that trigger when you're holstering, you're fine. Your finger should be nowhere near that trigger when holstering your gun. That's another reason for holsters that don't collapse. And I know I've talked about my High Noon Mr. Softy soft leather holster before that I like to sometimes carry my Glock 26 in and carry a Car PM9. I'm really not carrying that much anymore with that holster because it collapses. It doesn't have an open top. It doesn't have a reinforced mouth. And one-handed holstering is next to impossible. And I don't want to be getting my fingers anywhere near the muzzle of the gun when I'm trying to reholster. And I certainly don't want to get my finger anywhere near the trigger either. So, anyway, I kind of got off tangent there. But Gabe also talks about that some instructors comprehension about the real world should not interfere with the shooter's ability to fight with whatever he has in his hand at the moment of truth. Here's number two on Gabe's list of silly gun things that might get you killed. Thinking that one gun or one caliber combination is the answer for everything. It's the answer for all students, and it's the end-all, be-all. It's the holy grail of self-defense. One caliber, that's it. There are still people that think that way. Sorry if I seemed a little distracted there. I'm on Interstate 35 again driving, and I just went by a mail truck that forgot which side the gas pedal's on. Anyway, did I tell you guys about the caller into Tom Gresham's Gun Talk podcast, Gun Talk show a couple of weeks ago? I can't remember if I told you this or not. A guy calls in, and he wants to know what Tom Gresham's recommendation for him is on a 45. He said he wanted to buy a 45 because he said if he had to shoot somebody, he doesn't want to shoot somebody with a 9mm toothpick. That's what the caller said. And I love the classy response that Tom gave him. Just a super classy response. It was great. He said, hey, you know what? I might disagree with you, sir, that a 9mm is a toothpick. Just ask somebody who's been shot by one. But then he moved on quickly, and he gave the guy an answer on a 45. The guy had a specific budget, and Tom gave a good answer on what 45 to get. But this one caliber end-all be-all is garbage. All handguns suck. I did a whole podcast dedicated to how much handguns suck. I know this is the Handgun World Show, but they suck. When it comes to stopping power, they suck. If you know you're going to a gunfight, what do they say? Bring a rifle, and bring friends that have rifles. At the very least, bring a shotgun. And bring twice as many friends that have shotguns. If you know you're going into a gunfight. But how many of us know that we're going into a gunfight? That's unrealistic, isn't it? So, the bottom line of this point is, instructors that train for the use of one style of gun and one style of caliber, or instructors that tell their students when the classes are over, go get yourself, you know, one certain particular gun, otherwise you're not really self-defended, that's garbage. Now, before I get off this topic and move to the next one, I do want to say this. This is something I want to share with you that I thought was really cool. It also was on Tom Gresham's Gun Talk show. He had a guy from Gunsight on there. I forgot the man's name. Doggone it, I forgot the man's name and I forgot to write it here in my show notes. Anyway, they were talking about ammunition, 45 caliber ammunition specifically, and they were talking about carrying ball ammunition, full metal jacket for those of you that might be kind of new, versus hollow point 45s. And the guy from Gunsight said he was carrying a Colt lightweight commander loaded with 45 ACP ball ammo, FMJs. I think that's kind of cool, and I see nothing wrong with that. And his theory was that his gun feeds it perfectly. Again, reliability is really more important than anything else in a gunfight. And if his gun is reliable and flawless with the FMJs, with the ball ammo, and if he can put it where it needs to go, folks, 45 ACP ball ammo has gotten the job done many, many years. It is proven. It's been proven by the military. Yes, hollow points are great, but what happens if you're shooting a short-barreled 45? It's kind of suspect whether you can get good expansion out of those short-barreled guns with a 45. There's a lot of ballistic tests out there that show that sometimes they don't expand that well. And if a 45, any bullet doesn't expand, it's just as good then as a full metal jacket, as ball ammo, isn't it? If I were you and you're carrying a 1911 and you got 45 ACP ball in there, 230 grain, I would not feel under-defended. Not at all. It'll make some big holes probably in the front, and it'll make some big holes in the back of your attacker as it's leaving his body. I know you might say, oh, Bob, what about over-penetration? I'm not going there. You guys know how I feel about over-penetration. If you can control the full metal jacket, if you can put the rounds where they needed to go, and the most important thing is it feeds through your gun, that's great. All right, that concludes segment number two. Let's take another 30-second musical break, and then I'll come back on with the rest of Gabe Suarez's articles on the silly gun things that instructors teach that could get you killed. Be back in a minute. All right, in segment three, I'd like to finish this up. This is fantastic here, and it just makes so much sense what Gabe wrote, and I feel compelled to share this with you. Another silly gun school thing that is often taught is too much focus on long-range shooting. Let's face it, the vast majority of urban pistol fights occur within that 7-yard interval. Maybe 10 yards might be stretching it, okay? In terms of the average. Now, I'm sure you can all find a story out there where somebody had to shoot somebody else at 15 yards or more with a handgun. There might be stories like that, sure. So, those are the exception. I think the average is going to be that 7 to 10 yard window. And learning the basic fundamentals of shooting is essential, and so is learning to apply those fundamentals and apply them in mock gunfights. And the thing to remember here, this is what I've struggled with, because, you know, I might be like a lot of you. I like to test myself and test my gun and figure out, man, how far can I shoot this thing? I mean, it's a lot of fun to set up little tiny steel targets at 50 yards and plink away and try to hit those things. And stand there, you know, and get your perfect stance and your perfect sight picture and hold it real still and control that breathing and then gently just press the trigger. And then bang, and then listen to that gong when the bullet hits the steel at 50 yards. That's fun. That is a lot of fun. But is that realistic? You know, it's not. Gunfights are close-range, high-intensity confrontations, and they often occur by surprise. And here's another thing that's scary. Gunfights also typically involve more than one adversary. That's happened more and more these days. So getting hits is important, and it's similar similarly important, just as important, I meant to say, to get those hits fast. So the schools that teach, you know, excessive focus on long-range shots, the instructors that are trying to teach people to shoot long-range, I agree with Gabe on this. I just think that's just not realistic. And I got to say, even sometimes when I go shoot IDPA or I shoot USPSA, you know, they got these targets out there at 25 yards, 20 yards and stuff like that. Good marksmanship stuff. You know, do we really need to be spending a lot of time on that, though? Okay. Next. Hang on a second here. I'm driving and I had to get through a yellow light there. Just made that one. Okay. He also talks about excessive focus on scary gun handling. And the main point he makes here is that nobody wants to have a mishap with a firearm. But don't forget why we carry guns. If we want to be completely safe from any danger involving firearms, then it's his suggestion that we just leave them in the gun store and go take up golf as a hobby. Some instructors are so anal about this that they eliminate the combat utility of a gun. Okay? I mean, I'm not saying we should be unsafe, but some people are just way overboard with the fact that everything has to be absolutely done according to these super, super high standards so that nobody gets even remotely near the point where the pistol could be dangerous. And I guess what I'm saying is, even Jeff Cooper, the guy that coined the four rules of gun safety, he said that there's four rules because in case you break one of them, you're still going to be fine. And Gabe points out that one of those examples is, for example, rule two, don't let the muzzle cover anything that you're not willing to destroy. That's interesting until you stop to think about it. Think about the fact that you cover your leg every single time that you draw your holster. Excuse me, I believe I said that wrong. Every single time that you draw your gun and then also holster it, aren't you bringing that muzzle close to your leg? Isn't that happening? So, and you don't want to destroy your leg, right? So you're actually violating rule number two. You're letting the muzzle cover something that you don't really wish to destroy. Safety's fine. Reasonable safety. Scary gun handling will make you definitely unsafe and make you ineffective. And I submit it'll make you pretty dangerous, but, you know, let's not just get so anal about it. Okay, let's not take out the combative element of training with a handgun. You have to understand that as long as you're keeping your finger off of that trigger, that when you draw your pistol out of your gun, even though for a split second it may point at your leg, as long as your finger is not in the trigger, you're going to be fine. Sometimes in IDPA, you know, when you started a shooting at a sitting position, and you have to draw from a sitting position, you have to engage targets while you're sitting. I'm a right-hander. I'm a right-handed shooter. And if I'm starting with the target on my left, a lot of times, you know, the safety officer says, now, make sure, and he reminds everybody, make sure when you draw that you don't sweep your leg with the pistol. Well, you know, what he's saying is don't bring your muzzle in front of your leg. If my finger is off of the trigger, it's not going to be a problem. I've never understood that one. Somebody set me straight as to, if you're a safety officer out there, I'm not making fun of you guys. I know you have a job to do. I know it's important that everybody be safe at an IDPA match or a USPSA match. Yes. I mean, the sport will die. If people start getting hurt, that sport's going to die. I understand. We can't have people getting hurt. But somebody explain that one to me, okay? Send me an email, put a comment on the Gun Rights Radio Network forum, and explain that one. Now, here's another interesting point that Gabe makes, is some schools, some trainers, there's an over-reliance on sighted shooting or on point shooting. A modern technique trainer will say that you have to have a perfect sight picture always and everywhere because regardless of the dynamics of the event or the proximity of the problem, you've still got to have that perfect sight picture. And they follow the modern technique mantra, front sight press, front sight press. Because they fire carefully precise double taps at cardboard targets. Now, a trainer from a point shooting philosophy will say that gunfighting was figured out back before World War II, and that he never, ever, ever uses his sights, and he always uses one hand to shoot, and he scoffs at other systems as he launches a burst towards the intended target. And you know, most of the time he hits it somewhere. I think the reality of your training is somewhere in the middle. You can't have an overemphasis on sighted shooting to where you're always making sure that you're seeing your sights all the time, and there can't be an overemphasis on point shooting either. Because there are times where you're going to have to at least be able to index your sights, at least be able to get an outline, even if it's for a split second, at least be able to figure out where that muzzle is pointing and use your front sight as a guide. So, trainers that go too far one way or the other, they're either 100% sighted shooting or they're 100% on point shooting. I think that's the point that Gabe's trying to make here. At least that's my own flavor that I like to add to it. Realistically, a gunfight's probably going to be somewhere in between, and you're going to... There's some shots you might fire, and you're point shooting. There might be others where you're going to be fire... And maybe the first shot you've hit, you were point shooting on the first shot. Okay, you slowed your aggressor down, and now you might be able to get a good view of that front sight and get that front sight on target. Now, the other silly gun thing sometimes taught at schools that really could get you in trouble is the use of these elaborate target systems. Instead of human training partners, all these high-class target systems are used. Gabe talks about one trainer that actually designed a charging target system, and this thing runs right at you on pulleys. He's even patented it, and it requires you to stand on a spot and imagine some kind of a knife attacker is coming towards you, and your job is to draw and shoot him before he gets to you. You have to stand your ground, and you have to try to solve the problem with a fast draw. And the trainer usually says something like, on the street, you're going to have to move. But here in training, I want you to stand your ground and, make sure you don't shoot my expensive moving target either. Just shoot where you're supposed to shoot. And Gabe's point is a good one. He says some of these elaborate target systems like this, these moving targets and things, they'll train you for failure. Because they're going to prevent you from doing what the most natural thing for you to do if you're facing a knife attacker or something like that, and that's move. Moving off the X's, he calls it, and moving off the X's, James Yeager calls it. By the way, that reminds me while I'm doing this. I don't have this in my script, but just talking about moving off the X there reminded me of something. If some of you have not checked out the website getoffthex.com, I highly recommend it. Getoffthex.com. It's James Yeager's website, A Tactical Response. It's his forum. I frequent that forum a lot. I've been on there almost 4 years now. It is great. These guys know what fighting's all about. These guys know what gunfighting is all about. They know what practical self-defense is all about. So get on there. Getoffthex.com. Check it out. Now, another little, silly thing that could get you killed that a lot of gun schools focus on, that Gabe Suarez talks about, is they ignore combatives. Now, let's face it. People don't always like combatives. I mean, that's not something that people... I don't get all that excited about it, but you have to train yourself. Some people hate getting pushed around, and they hate getting hit, and they hate having their clothes ripped and stuff like that when they're in training, or getting shot with airsoft guns and stuff like that. It's no fun. Even though you got a lot of padding on and stuff like that, it's still no fun. But in order to handle those kinds of problems, you have to train in those types of combative environments. And most gun schools just pretty much ignore the problem, and they don't even concentrate on that. And they don't train on any kind of combative techniques. They don't talk about weapons retention training. They don't talk about disarms. They don't talk about maneuvering or anything like that, or moving off the X, or being up close and personal with your attacker and stuff like that. They don't get into that, and that's a huge disservice, because in a reality, and I like to talk about reality, I like to keep this show rooted in common sense, that's what you're going to face. Knowing what we know today, to tell some kind of a shooter student, that they're ready for a confrontation just because they can fire a nice tight little group on a piece of paper and so forth at 20 yards. That's kind of like telling a martial arts student that he's ready to take on a street gang empty-handed because he's been good at kicking that bag. You know, that's one of the reasons why I've got my son enrolled in MMA. That's why he's in mixed martial arts. And that's why I carefully picked the school that does teach combatives. My son, at the age of 12, is learning hand-to-hat combatives. And some people say, oh, Bob, man, mixed martial arts, you're teaching him to be a savage. No. I'm not teaching my son to be a savage by enrolling him in mixed martial arts. I'm teaching my son to learn how to live in case he's in a situation. And that's what I'm talking about here. And finally, the last point here that I think is a real good one that Gabe talks about that isn't taught much in schools, in shooting schools at all, is excessive concerns about the aftermath. And he writes that in today's world, nobody really wants to get into a confrontation. He's right about that. I don't want to get into a confrontation. I don't go looking for a gunfight. Confrontations are dangerous, and you might get killed. And of course, they could be very, very expensive. But when your strategies of avoiding a confrontation fail, you only have one choice, folks. You have to be ready to transition into attack mode. And you might say, well, you might get sued, Bob. Well, yeah, you might get sued. Sure. So, you know, protect your assets. Do what you have to do. Make sure you have the right attorneys. Make sure you have good insurance. Okay, but don't die because you're afraid of getting sued. Don't fail to stop your attacker by using the one weapon, the only weapon that you might have at that point, at that moment of truth, which is probably going to be your firearm. Don't not use it because you're afraid of getting in trouble. So you might ask, well, you know, some politically motivated prosecutor is going to hang me. Well, you know what? Have a good attorney on your friends list. I've told you before. There is an attorney that I know personally, and he's pretty good with criminal defense. I've got his business card, and we've emailed back and forth and so forth. So, you know, he knows that I carry, and we just leave it at that. I hope I never have to call him, but if I do, I know where to get a hold of him, and he's ready to serve. But as Gabe says, remember, being broke and being in jail is a temporary thing. Being dead is not temporary. And what's worse is having a loved one dead because you hesitated to act. And with that, time for another break, and then I'll come back. This next segment's going to be just real short. I've got something I want to say, and then I'll wrap up the show. Thanks. Okay, back with you for segment number 3. This is going to be kind of short. I just want to address a couple things. Recently, I got some constructive criticism, and it was negative, but that's okay. I'm open-minded to that stuff. It was about episode number 70. Apparently, I ruffled a few feathers with that. I didn't mean to. I was just trying to impart some information from somebody else who was a liberal that likes guns and was trying to wake liberals up and tell liberals, hey, wake up and fly right when it comes to the Second Amendment. But a couple people have made comments that they didn't like some of my commentary that I put in there. And let me just say this. If you go back and you listen to the first six minutes of episode number 70, for those of you that criticize that, you will note that I said that both conservatives and liberals out there, some politicians have very poor Second Amendment records. And it doesn't matter whether they have a D, an R, or an I before their name. I don't care. And I'm going to go ahead and say it again. Any politician that doesn't support the Second Amendment, I don't support them. This show is about guns. My show is not about politics. So I'm not getting into any of those other political issues. I will get into, from time to time, not very often, I will get into Second Amendment politics. Not very often, though, folks. There's a lot of good politics shows out there on the Second Amendment that you can listen to. I want this show to be about the practical ownership and shooting and owning and carrying of firearms. But what I wanted to do there, folks, was tell you about another liberal writer that wants her constituents to wake up and fly right when it comes to the Second Amendment, because they know that it's a losing issue for them to oppose the Second Amendment. That's all I was trying to do. I was not trying to impose politics on anybody. So please, you know, one thing I don't like being is I don't like being misquoted, and I don't like being misunderstood. Some of you who sent me some comments said that I was making statements that liberals don't like guns. I didn't say that in episode 70. I said a vast majority of liberals have very poor gun voting records. Very poor voting records. That's what I was saying. And so do conservatives. I will call out any conservative or any Republican, whatever they want to call themselves, or libertarian, if they're not pro-Second Amendment, I will call them out and I will criticize them. I guess you could say I'm an equal opportunity criticizer. If these pinheads don't support our right that's protected in the Constitution, then vote the bums out. That's my philosophy. So, please, you know, this is the last time I'm going to say it. I really don't want to beat this dead horse anymore. I really just don't want to continue to pound on this. But I am not behind this microphone trying to bash liberal people. I think that that lady, Kaylee Joy Gray, who is a writer for the Daily Coast, I think she hit the nail right on the head when it comes to the issue of Second Amendment. She was absolutely correct, and I said that in episode 70, so there you go. I've had some of you email me and say, hey, Bob, you know what? I'm a liberal and I like guns and thank you for your show. Just because we don't agree on other political or issues, let's make the Second Amendment a uniting cause, okay? Let's all rally behind the Second Amendment. Let's put our political differences at the door, and if you are a believer that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, then I want you to do two things. Quit trying to say that I don't like liberals, and buy a raffle ticket for my freedom raffle. That's a uniting cause. My freedom raffle is open to anybody. If I didn't like liberals, I would ask liberals not to buy a ticket. I would ask just conservatives to buy a ticket. I want everybody to buy a ticket and support the Second Amendment. That is, if you support the Second Amendment, okay? So let's just keep this show about guns. Let's not go into political rantings and ravings and things, because that's not where I want it to go. All right? Please be accurate when you take issue with things that I say. I don't mind it, just be accurate. Be accurate and set me straight. I never mind it if you set me straight. That's fine. If I'm wrong, I'll admit it. I'll get on this show and I will admit where I'm wrong and I'll correct my mistakes. Okay? That's it. That's all I'm going to say about that. Not going to bring it up, but I did want to address that. So, finally, before I close the show, think about your training. Think about what are you learning in the training classes that you're taking. Is the instructor biased? Try not to take training from a biased instructor. And there are some. Folks, we're all human beings. We all have our preferences and our likes. You know, I mean, hey, is it any secret that I like Glocks? It's no secret, but if you have a 1911, or if you have a Beretta, or XD, or an M&P, or a revolver, that's okay. Somebody on the Gun Rights Radio Network forum put up a great post. He says, hey, Bob, you never talk about revolvers. How come? The reason I don't talk about revolvers is I don't know that much about them, and I don't want to spew off my mouth, and I don't want to start shooting off and be a talking head about something I don't know about. I don't like to talk about guns that I haven't shot or owned. That's my policy. I am going to go to the range, and I'm going to rent a bunch of revolvers and shoot them and do a podcast. That's coming up. But I just, you know what, it irritates me when I read forum posts and I read internet chatter and I even hear some podcasters shooting their mouth off about stuff that they've never owned. I don't criticize a gun if you've never shot it or own it. At least go to the range and run 150 to 200 rounds through a gun. Rent it and shoot it before making a comment on it or before doing a podcast or an internet post about it. That's my feeling. But sir, you know what? That was a great comment you posted, and you're right. I need to talk more about revolvers, because revolvers are excellent defensive tools. You need to train with a revolver as well. And I'll do some research. Here in the next couple weeks, I think I'm going to go to the range. It's fun to rent guns anyway and shoot different types of guns. I'm going to go and I'm going to rent some revolvers and do a podcast review on a few of the major revolvers out there. But think about your training. What are you doing and how are you doing it? And are you training in such a way that it's going to save your life? That's it. That's all I want to say. I'll go ahead and sign off. This is Bob Main, and this has been episode number 71 of the Handgun World Show. And why do I carry a gun? That's pretty simple. Because I can't carry a cop. Thanks for tuning in. I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Send lawyers, guns, and money. This shit has hit the fan. Guns and money.